by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. One of the great parts of this show is having a relationship with Wyoming Game and Fish so that you can ask any questions that you would like if you need something answered. And we did talk last week about the upcoming meetings that you can go and ask questions in person. And you can find those dates out at the WGFD.wyo.gov website. And Casper going to have six of those meetings. So make sure to plan and go see them and let your voice be heard when it comes to mule deer. And Janet, I know that there's not just mule deer here. There are a lot of different animals that kind of wrapping up a lot of the seasons now. And some folks have switched over to bird hunting and waterfowl hunting, but there are some of us that are still searching for that elk.
That one elk, and we can't wait to hear your story, Drew. But yeah, you're spot on. And you know, one of the things that we continually say, and I know that we sound like a broken record sometimes, though, is how important public input is into our season setting process. And we all talk about how our season setting process is a year-round process. And we really want to remind people of that. But one of the key things that is so important is as these hunting seasons wind down, people will start to get notified about harvest surveys. And those are fantastic surveys that we put out that give us critical information into managing wildlife across Wyoming.
So these surveys aren't a, you know, like the government checking up on you. Like this is really information of what you saw in the field or how you did in the field.
Absolutely. And every year our managers sit down. We have fantastic folks across the state that sit down and talk about our harvest surveys and put those together to make sure that we're getting the information that we want. And Justin Benfitt is here with us and can talk a little bit more as he is not a manager anymore. He is now one of the big wigs within the agency, but he is, very coursed in how he has used these hunter surveys in the past, these harvest surveys, excuse me, and really knows the benefit of each species that we ask about and how we use that data. So Justin, welcome to talk about it.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Drew. Thanks, Janet. I thought you were going to say short for a second.
Well, yeah, that too, but.
Drew, I mean, Janet touched on it, but you know, folks, now that we're kind of through the busiest part of hunting seasons, you know, there are those elk hunters. We'll have elk hunters clear out to the end of January for sure. But is what folks are already starting to get from us are our notifications for harvest surveys. And that is honestly one of the most pivotal, important pieces of data that we collect that helps inform management for all of our species across the board.
And Justin, you've been doing this for a long time. Janet, you've been with the agency for a long time. So you both have seen the way that, you know, these surveys have really advanced and taken the step into the next level. I mean, I'm sure back in the day they started out as a mailer and now they all go on the technical side. So really it's an easy way now. And I assume that you get more return than maybe you did when they were mailers.
Well, our harvest survey process is ever evolving. In fact, we actually just kind of moved it. We're now contracting with the University of Wyoming to help do that. And so with technology and that sort of thing, yeah, we have gotten out of the mailroom by and large. Drew, you're exactly right. And now most folks are getting notified via email. And we've actually done some further streamlining of our harvest survey process this year. Folks are going to get a survey. And then once they get there, they're going to have the opportunity once they log in to fill out surveys for all the licenses in which they had. So it's even new and improved this year.
Yeah. And I know that I've gotten a couple of different for fishing and for waterfowl and hunting that I'd done like that too. So those are all out there right now, and it kind of gets a little overwhelming when you're like, oh, did I fill it out? Do I not fill it out?
Which one did I fill out? Yeah. That's the other question, right? If you happen to be lucky enough to draw all three species or more than three species, you get tons of them. So it is critical that we do get those back from you, though.
Yeah. And so now we're streamlining it where you should just get notified and then you'll have the opportunity to fill all those out. And even if, for example, like you've harvested your deer and your antelope, but not your elk yet, you'll still have the opportunity to go back in and fill that out later. But I'd really like to just stress the importance. There's some folks think, oh, it's just another email from the government or survey or whatever. But this directly informs management. I can't tell you how many times in my 22-year career, it's every time when we're talking about how many licenses are we going to issue for the next year. You know, we're looking at population trends and buck ratios or, you know, bull ratios and all that kind of stuff. But on top of it, you know, if we see real improvements in license success or like, which means the number of animals like hunters were able to harvest, the percentage of successful hunters, those sorts of things that, you know, or if we see conversely like a real decline in hunter success, you know, that kind of tells us maybe hunters had a harder time finding their antelope or their deer. And we will absolutely make adjustments to seasons next year in part based on what those harvest surveys tell us. So it's one of the most important pieces of data that we can collect.
And one of the things that Justin is leaving out is how we get that. You know, in the past, we have put that together and we send that out to everyone in the wildlife division gets copies of that. And we're able to review and read every single comment verbatim as to how it's submitted. And everybody gets this. So it's not just one person in the agency who sees this and can then choose what, you know, you want to pass on and what you don't. And that's really good for us. There's often a lot of feedback for us individually as well as in the management. And so keeping that in mind, like we see it all and it is important to everyone.
When people do multiple hunting, you know, we just talked about they could be out doing all three of the big species, but they also do the waterfowl and everything. Is there one of the surveys that is more important for someone to respond to than others?
No. I mean, you know, there's some maybe pieces of survey data that gets used a little bit less than others. So for example, blue grouse seasons, dusky grouse seasons don't tend to change year in and year out. But we view all of this information as important or we wouldn't ask for it. You know, it's incumbent upon us as the wildlife managers of the state to have an idea based in science on how many animals that are being harvested across the state. I mean, it's one of the, you know, foundational pieces of wildlife management.
And while these surveys may not dictate what happens today or for the next season, they do contribute to long-term data. So let's just say the dusky goes down in 10 years. We can look back at all of this data and see, okay, here's what the public was saying. Here was what the harvest survey said. We can see that, okay, right here might have really been a pivotal time to be looking at this population. And so all of it contributes, whether it's today, tomorrow, or 50 years from now.
So when you're looking back, say you get to, you know, looking at the surveys and everything, how many years will you clump together and be like, okay, we're going to take this section of years and this session of years, or will you go back 50 years like Janet said?
Well, it really just depends on the species we're talking about. I mean, for example, new for this past year, we had a sage grouse permit requirement, right? And that was, you know, there we found like we just wanted to ensure that we were surveying hunters in the best way possible. And having this permit helped us kind of isolate, you know, sage grouse hunters so we could better target them. In that case, like anytime we're looking at sage grouse harvest as a percentage of the population in the state, especially given, you know, past attempts to put those on the endangered species list, things like that, it's really important for us to go back decades into harvest trends. For big game, I mean, we use it year in and year out. You know, things like cottontail rabbits, it's really, really interesting to look at cycles over the years. You know, you can look at like 10-year increments of cottontail rabbit harvest and then infer what those populations did, because when we have more harvest is when we have more rabbits. And that corresponds with sage grouse male lek attendance really, really well. When we got lots of rabbits, predators have other things to eat, you know, and that can actually help sage grouse populations. So that stuff can all be intertwined to some extent, you know, and it's really interesting to have decades worth of that information to pour back through.
And this is a complete side note, but as Justin mentioned, the sage grouse permit, we talked about it on the show, Drew, a couple months ago. And just a huge thanks to all of the listeners. The Casper region had 100% compliance. Every single sage grouse hunter that was checked had that permit and was super helpful in providing data to us. So a huge thanks. And that is a prime example. Justin used those, you know, how we use that data. So again, we're not tracking you. The harvest survey is not tracking you. We just are super thankful to everyone who helps provide us scientific data.
When you go back and look at these numbers, Justin, do you have certain people that will look at certain, species? So you'll have a group of folks that'll just do mule deer, and then those that'll do antelope and elk, or does everybody basically jump in feet first on all of it?
For the most part, those district biologists and then the regions and then game wardens certainly get looped into all this stuff as well. They're looking at the stuff for their districts, right, or their regions. And so, you know, they're going through the deer, elk, and antelope data, or moose or sheep or whatever it may be, you know, for the hunt areas in which they manage. But then there's other species like our waterfowl stuff. We have a statewide person that's kind of in charge of helping compile all that information, but then disseminates it out statewide to all those regions and biologists and wardens, et cetera. So like we have a statewide sage grouse biologist that does it for sage grouse. And we have some non-game folks that will help compile a bunch some statewide folks that will compile some of the small game stuff is what I meant to say. And so it kind of depends. But for the most part, those folks everyone gets a chance to look at the entire state.
And we talk about it being year long. And I think people are like, okay, we get it. It's year long. But really, I think it's important to really drive home that you get these surveys back, and that's just a little piece of what you're looking at for the whole year to determine what next year is going to be like.
Yeah. And thanks for bringing that up, Drew, because it is a year-round process in terms of, you know, not just like what we say season setting is, which is really our management process, but really it's like with harvest surveys, folks see the big pulse and, you know, the big push from us comes in the fall because that's big game stuff. But, you know, we're doing harvest surveys for small game in the spring because those seasons go through the winter, and mountain lion and black bears. We have spring black bear seasons and turkey seasons and fall black bear and turkey season. So, you know, depending on when those seasons are, at the end of those seasons, that's when we'll send out those surveys. I mean, and, you know, that doesn't even count our fish division that will occasionally survey folks on. There was just one that came out, I'm sure Janet talked to you about, on North Platte River anglers. So just collecting that public survey data, whether it's a harvest survey or a hunter attitude survey, it's all, you know, the public telling us what they harvested and informing our management.
When we talk about the upcoming meetings, which will be just in a little while, actually, how do you use the verbal feedback? I mean, is that something that somebody's taking notes or?
Well, when it comes to meetings, it also depends on the meetings. Like these upcoming mule deer meetings, absolutely, we're gonna record and capture all the comments. And we'll go through those and disseminate those out to everybody, and we can all have a chance to digest that. When it comes to what Janet was referring to, like formal written comments, that those are meetings that pertain to actual open regulations. Yes. So those are sometimes they're two different things. You know, we also get we also get comments that just come back on the harvest survey, like Janet mentioned earlier, those get disseminated to everybody too. So we're always incorporating, synthesizing, digesting, you name it, public input throughout the year.
And I would assume that if someone gives you a verbal comment or a question, when you're going through the surveys and that it's answered or it really highlights one of the surveys that comes in, that maybe multiple people are having that same question. I mean, maybe they aren't used right away, but eventually it will come back up.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when common themes emerge, which they do, it helps paint a picture of what public sentiment is, you know, regarding, you know, how we're managing a certain species or, you know, what folks like, what folks don't like, that sort of thing. And it's always a challenge for us to figure out how much, you know, where we can incorporate public input. We strive to make changes based on what we hear from the public all the time. But it's also, you know, I'd be dishonest if I said we can make a change based on everything we hear, because we get public input that runs the gamut, and some of it is feasible for us to implement and some of it may not be.
Well, you think back to when we were looking at grizzly bear listing and delisting, notebook after notebook after notebook. I mean, tens of thousands of pages of just a form letter comment even. And so, you know, there might be one or two comments that are missed in those situations that we're not able to deal with. But just know that everything that comes in, we do take to heart. We do listen to. And, you know, sometimes we can make those changes and sometimes we can't. And, you know, as the world kind of continues down different pathways, we just need to remind folks that we have different political, different social, and different biological components to wildlife management that we always have to deal with. And that is one of the things that can be a challenge for us as an agency. And we continue to work through and work with and hope that the public can, you know, help us out with that scientific piece as much as they can, because that is huge for us when it comes to the social and political aspect of wildlife management.
Well, it's very important you give your feedback, and it's very important that you continue to do this and fill out those surveys. And if you haven't gotten one yet, but you've been hunting, keep an eye on your email, right?
That's right.
And Drew, we've streamlined it enough. We've shortened it up even more this year. It's pretty simple. It doesn't even take 2 minutes of your time. And not only do we appreciate it, we view it as a vital piece of information to manage your wildlife.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Drew and Brian Woodward from Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. Well, Brian, today is the last day of the Black Friday weekend sale, but that's not stopping the deals, because Christmas is just right on around the corner.
Boy, you know, we've been talking about how time flies, and like, you know, we were just spring fishing, and you know, now we got Thanksgiving and Christmas will be here like in a week, I think, you know. So yeah, we got a bunch of specials still going on for our 3-day ad that'll end today, and then we all have another ad that is running for the entire week. So if you missed out, we still have a lot of those specials in the store. We're not one of those companies that advertised some great deals and didn't have any.
Oh right,
we've got a lot of them. So we tried to make sure that we were able to take care of the customers as they came in. So don't be afraid to swing by and try to pick up some of those deals.
So, and we've been talking about this a little bit, because this will be my dad's first trip out here for a hunt, and he's a little bit worried, but then I send him a picture of what the forecast is on Thursday and Friday, and it's like 50, you know, and so during the day. So I don't think he's as worried anymore, but, you know, even if we get a good drop there on Saturday, there's still opportunity to come in and get what he needs in the store, and that's kind of the best part of about the store.
Well, and that's just it. You know, like, people are traveling through, kind of look at the weather forecast, but, you know, you and I know that just because it says it's going to be 50 tomorrow doesn't mean it's not going to be 32.
Right. And you throw that wind in there, 50 can feel like, you know, negative zero, you know? I mean, it's just, it's so wild how it can change in that much of an instant. So come on in and check it out. Of course, some late season big game wrapping up a little bit, but you know, you're going to process it yourself. And I saw a guy on one of the social media networks that was doing a video with himself, mm-hmm. but basically made fun of his other self for, you know, not doing it the manly way and right. processing it yourself.
Yeah, you know, I've already harvested my bull and my cow elk, and we'll hopefully get yours next weekend. But I was able to use both 307 processing and Dan's. I just kind of split it up between the two. And I tell you, like, the price is about the same on both of them, and they both did a fantastic job. And both of them offer a few little bit of different services. But, you know, we're kind of getting to that point now where I think, you know, some of those processors are shutting down or getting a very limited amount of elk that right. can come in because they're starting to rotate over to process their beef and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of whether or not you can get in that day. You might have to be able to hold that animal for an extra day. But they both did a fantastic job. And, you know, if you are out of time like I was, you know, I generally process all my own, but I had some other commitments going on. They did a great job. But if you want to do it yourself, I mean, again, we've got all the grinders and slicers and stuffers and all the bags and, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, we've definitely a good opportunity to do it yourself.
Yeah. And you know what? If maybe it's your kid's first time, that's a great parent. Child thing to do, you know. Yeah. It may be a lot of work, but yeah, it's fun.
I remember watching those videos of like with the dad showing their kids about the turkey, you know, and pulling the turkey neck out. If you've seen them, you know.
Yeah. It's funny. We were just talking about this the other day where, you know, there's still fall turkey season that goes through the end of the year pretty much. So, but if you look at some of the birds, they're really big right now, too. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, we just had Thanksgiving. It doesn't mean that Christmas isn't going to have a good turkey.
Right. Yeah. I mean, between the turkey seasons, you know, we got pheasant seasons and bird farms around the area that are all opened up mm-hmm. and waterfowl. I mean, there's still plenty to do. And, you know, those turkeys, I think, you know, I think Game and Fish would like us to even thin some of those out.
Yeah, no kidding. And I know that it's a big thing in town. We just need to reiterate, you can't shoot them in town.
You can't shoot them in town.
You can't trap them in town. You can't poison them in town. So, you know, leave them alone in town.
Yeah.
We have also got a lot of opportunities here in the near future. Ice fishing will be opening up, you know, probably first of the year if we can drop the temperature and get some ice. And I saw on Facebook there were people that were you know, wandering over in the Pinedale area because sure. that usually is a pretty early time to go ice fishing, but there's open water over there still too. So
yeah, you know, some of those higher elevation lakes are going to get, you know, froze up quicker than others. You know, Boisen, the south end of that reservoir, tends to ice up in those bays pretty early, and usually by Christmas, you know, we're out there doing some fishing. I know last year, you know, we were still on Glendo on December 25th out of a boat. So yeah, just be real cautious as you get out there and make sure that, you know, you plan ahead and, you know, take yourself a throw rope, and, you know, it's good to have some type of flotation that, you know, in case someone does go through, you can get them out of there, change of clothes, you know, heaters, all that kind of stuff that you hopefully don't need, but, you know, be prepared for it.
Yeah. And, you know, also, if you're heading out and maybe the family goes out on pheasant hunts at Christmas, or maybe it's a turkey hunt this year, you know, make sure to come on in and get all your safety gear. You got to make sure that you got your tags and you got your licenses. And, you know, if you're going ORVing or snowmobiling, you got to have all that all too.
Yeah. So we're kind of in a dead period for ORV and snowmobile tags. I think those are kind of shut down until December 1st. So we're just around the corner. Mm-hmm. In the next couple of days, you'll be able to get that. And just know that if you are going to get a snowmobile tag or ORV tag, we just need make, model, all that, you know, information off your registration, VIN number, that kind of stuff to get you in the system. But we can do those tags right here in the store, issue you those tags so you can get right out in the field.
If somebody is coming in for you know, a hunting license, you know, they want to get a small game, they want to get, you know, the bird license, mm-hmm. what all information do they need to have with them when they get the license?
As long as they're an adult, then we can use like an ID or a driver's mm-hmm. license. You have to have something to prove your residency, basically. If you have a youngster that's still in school, they'll just actually have to fill out kind of an affidavit that says what school they're attending for the last year. Again, just kind of proving residency, but really a pretty simple process. When you are, for the first time that you're getting your child a Game and Fish license, you do have to have the last four of their social security number. And that's usually what that gets dad tied up. You know, dad usually has to call mom at the counter going, hey, what's Johnny's social security number? But that's only for the very first time that you're registering into the Game and Fish system to actually acquire their sportsman's ID number. Once the sportsman's ID numbers, it's pretty easy just to come in and renew and get tags or whatever you need.
Yeah, and then make sure that you're carrying those with you when you're out in the field, because you got to have that and your hunter safety card for proof of that. So you got to have it on you when you're in the field. And I always like to remind people like that, especially if maybe that's a once-a-year mm-hmm. hunter or something like that.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times, you know, a lot of guys are just going like on a one-time duck or goose hunt. Maybe they're going to Torrington for a goose hunt during the Christmas break or whatever. You still have to have a waterfowl stamp, which we do sell here at the store, and you have to have a HIP permit, which you can just do on the computer yourself. It's more of a survey, but it is a requirement to be in the field if you're going to do any waterfowl hunting. So make sure you have those. But again, duck stamps we can take care of, and generally we can sign you onto the computer so you can do your own HIP permit here. We can print it out so you have a copy of it as well.
Very good. Get in and check it out. Rocky Mountain Discount Sports CY in Casper or RockyMountainSports.com.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. Today in on location, really, Dan's Meat Processing. Have Jen and Josh and guys. You guys is where I brought my elk earlier this fall, and you got it, you know, done. You got her up. But the process of this is awesome because you have it down pat. Obviously, you've been doing it for years and years and years. But something that is kind of cool is when you walk in here, you feel like family. You know, even if you've never really met, because I've only met you guys just a couple of times. And the process of this is, you know, you guys could be dealing with somebody's elk that it's their very first elk, like mine, or is a trophy elk, and you want to get them in and get them out and make sure that they have everything done. And I know, Josh, as soon as you were out, you were taking care of things, you were starting the skinning process, and Jen, you were starting the paperwork process. So it really is a fun, fast process when you come in here.
Oh, it is. Yep, definitely. You know, we work pretty good as a team, I think. We want people to have the right information when they come here. We try to get to know the hunters. We want them to come back, obviously. You know, that's our business. You know, that's what keeps us going. So we enjoy visiting with them, helping them out if they have questions.
One of the things that you guys had told me is the proper way when you're in the field, and that could be a make or break situation. And Jen, I know as soon as, you know, I came in, you kind of asked me what I wanted, but then going out and seeing the meat was the next part of the process, because if it's bad at all, you can't bring it inside the building.
Right. You definitely have to be careful about what you got going on.
When someone is out in the field, they take their shot, they get their shot down. What's the best way for them to open up and get their elk or their deer or moose or antelope to the proper position for them to bring it to you?
Well, when you get it down, you want to, you know, the first thing is try to get it cooled down. That's the most important part. So you want to get them gutted. If it's a trophy, you're going to have a cape done, you know, from the back of the head, come up the back a little ways, but you want to get down into the bone in the neck, get it opened up, get it cooling down. We see a lot of guys that they want to do a shoulder mount. So they leave the hide intact. And we're going to cut right up the back of that neck anyway. So is a taxidermist. So you want to get that opened up and cooled out. And after that, you want to get them on their back. You want to get them opened up after they're gutted, get the hips broke, split them open, get some ice down in there after they're gutted. That's the biggest thing is cooling. Get good airflow around it. Don't pack, you know, all your gear on top of your animal in the back of the vehicle. Don't pack three or four animals on top of each other. You want to try to get some airflow.
The real problem that you guys have seen, and you were telling me that this year alone, it has been quite a few of, you know, nice looking elk that have come in and you haven't been able to process them. Is that because they didn't do that process right? Or is it another issue that's going on?
I would say that it's not getting cooled down fast enough. Too warm right now to be killing things.
Right.
And not being able to take care of it. Keeping it in the back of your truck for a few days, not ventilated, not iced down, is going to be an issue.
So when someone gets their elk down, their deer down, taking care of it right away and then bringing it to you right away is another thing too, because if it does sit in the back of your truck, then, you know, that's not doing it any good that way either. No,
sitting on the bed of the truck is, all it does is generate more heat. If you get a pallet up under there, I know everybody can't get a pallet, but even a piece of wood, anything to elevate it a little bit. There's a lot of animals that had other animals eat at it, which taints the meat, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it taints it, definitely. It you know, it gets the saliva from the animal, so bacteria, you know, so we got to cut all that away when we process. You know, we're not going to put that in your burger or leave it on there for the steaks or anything.
Get the esophaguses and the anuses out.
Yep.
Because that is going to be your biggest bacteria starter.
So make sure that the digestive tract and everything is out of that animal. Because what could happen if they don't get that out? I mean, is it going to start rotting the meat? Is it going to just taint the meat like you just said? Or
we're going to peel it right out.
Yeah, it's going to do both. There's bacteria in the digestive tract that, you know, it'll multiply and it'll start growing everywhere outside of the digestive tract when it gets on the meat. Mold. We have a lot of people that bring them in because there is no airflow. They get moldy. You know, and we've been on a list this year. We've been full, you know. So, you know, 4 or 5 days, you know, as long as you get a ventilation around it, you'll be fine. But if you don't get that digestive tract out, it's going to start, the bacteria is going to start growing. Now, if you're doing a cape, absolutely. You can't get the trachea out, leave it in. That's fine. Get as much of it out as you can. And then as soon as you get to the processor, you know, or your taxidermist, whoever's doing the cape, then pull it off.
How long is the process? I know when I came in, I was only here for maybe 15 minutes. So you've done your field dressing, you have it cooled off, you bring it in here. Then you basically go out, you unload it, and you start rolling with it, right?
Yep, absolutely. We you back up, we get it off your vehicle onto the rail. If it needs to be skinned, we bring it in, we skin it. If it's elk moose, we get a weight on it. Wash it down, and then we get it in the cooler. And then usually, you know, this year was a little bit longer, but usually it's, you know, 7 to 10 days. We'll get it in, get it processed. Jen will be giving you guys a call once we're done.
So one of the things that you were telling me when I dropped mine off was, you know, I got stick. So the process takes a little bit longer there. So Josh, you take the meat and you start to cut it up. You start the steaks, you get things that are going to be ground and then things that are going to be made into sausage or sticks. And then Jen, it's handed over to you. If I bring in my elk, am I taking my elk home?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Always 100% your own meat.
Which is one of the questions that I had after we talked last time was people were like, okay, well, you know, they take it in there and they just put it all together. And I said, no, I don't think so.
No, not here. I don't know about, I can't speak for anybody else, but we don't do that here. It's one animal on the table at all times.
Yep.
One animal in the grinder at all times. The first part of the chub, we clean out the chubber before we put the next animal in. So that way you're getting all of your own meat.
Which is, you know, it's what people want.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
If you're killing your first elk, you want to eat your elk. I mean, yeah. it's a mental thing because, you know, it probably all tastes the same. You know, it's like chicken, right? Where it's all...
I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you don't want, you know, most hunters, they want their animal. You know, you don't want somebody's antelope that ran, you know, 14 hours, you know, that day before it was shot. Brought in and they drug it down the road and it's dirty and, you know, so you want the animal that you brought in, that you took care of, you know, so that we've always done that. We've never ever mixed, you know, anybody's meat together and ground it that way. It's by order. And it's from beginning to end, you know, so.
Right.
And you have said that's how it's always been. I mean, you guys have been doing this for a long time. And
Dad's
been
doing it since 73.
73.
He started it in like a garage.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So, Josh, when did you start cutting meat?
1999 is when I really started cutting. And I've been processing probably 25, 26 years now.
Wow. And how many animals do you process a season? Can you put a number on it, or is it just...
Well, right now, how many have we got on here?
Well, we're at 1160, I think, right now, as of this instance. 2 years ago, we were 1580, yeah. I think, for the year.
That was right after COVID.
Yeah, right after COVID.
Everybody was out hunting, right?
Yeah.
Because nobody could go anywhere.
Right. You know, Josh does the cutting, and then you really take care of getting what people want so Josh can cut it. And then when it comes to the sausage packing and those types of deals, I mean, it really is hands-on for you.
Yep, absolutely. We wrap it, get it in the freezer. It takes me a few days to call you and do the invoices, depending on how many people I have that day. Get it to you. There's sticks. We pull it out. We freeze it. And then once we get a chance to start doing batches, we'll pull a full house, full smokehouse out, and mix their own. Every batch is mixed separately. Every batch is pushed through the sausage maker separately, and then put on the rack separately. So
it is quite the process. And if you've never come in to check out the process, you should. Now, you guys also, not only are you doing process for wild game, but I mean, this is a big time because you just went through Thanksgiving and turkeys mm-hmm. and hams. And yep. so that's why it takes a little longer to get your sticks.
Yes. Yes. I tell everybody 2 months in the very beginning. And if you haven't heard from me within that first 2 months, and it's during November and December, it's dedicated to the turkeys, smoked hams. That these 2 months are usually when smoked prime ribs. Yep. Right now now that we're into Christmas season, it's turkeys and prime ribs and some hams.
Yeah, some. Hams are hard to get by right now, so we're doing turkeys and we do smoked prime rib and then we do rub prime rib and naked prime rib. Ribs. But So
it's prime rib season. We're still doing this. And then we go we're doing buffalo now, and then we go right into beef.
Yeah. So really, it's a non-stop process here. You get finished with the big game, and you're right on to the next animal, whatever it is.
Right into domestic. They have some beef and hogs and sheep and so.
Well, if you haven't stopped in here and checked these guys out, Dan's Meat Processing in Evansville, you can't miss it. It's right in town. And guys, I appreciate it. I know the meat that I've eaten so far is fantastic, and everybody that I've let eat my meat. they're very happy with it.
Yeah.
So, but thank you guys so much.
No, thank you, Drew. Thank you, Drew. We appreciate it.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Welcome to Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. And you know, one of the best parts about Wyoming is the opportunity to do some shooting. And you know, if your ears are really taking a beating, we have a way that you can fix that and really have helping out a local business here. And we have Torian Wiggs with us of Red, White, and Blued. Thanks for coming on with us.
Appreciate the invitation, sir.
It's nice to see someone local being able to take their skills and master them. And earlier this year, you were actually picked as part of the startup, one of the top startups in the Casper area. And, you know, it's got to be pretty incisive and make you feel pretty good that Casper's behind you.
It was an honor, honestly. I didn't expect it, and it was well worth the effort, and the support has been, I don't have a better word than outstanding.
You and I met up at an event at Stahoo's where, you know, it was a great afternoon of firearms and kind of getting together with other guys that are enthusiasts and ladies. And you were telling me a little bit about the method and the reasoning for your startup and your invention and your work. You're a craftsman, so you're a gunsmith, and you really are focusing those skills to make these great products.
Yeah, we've been in business a while. It was the startup challenge is open to more than just brand new businesses. It's open to existing businesses that have new ideas that are expanding in a different direction, which is kind of where we fell into it. We designed a suppressor for centerfire rifles. I've been in the gunsmithing and the firearms world for quite some time, and one of the largest complaints I've ever had from customers is that, you know, they'd like to get into a sound suppressor for their firearms, which for both hunting now, because there's 42 states that legalized hunting with a suppressor, it's better for game, a lot of conservation pluses there. And they're looking at the long term. These are highly regulated items, take a lot of paperwork to get into, and they don't want to have something that's going to wear out or not be serviceable. So we took on that challenge and moved forward with that and came up with a product that fulfills everything that we really wanted it to do.
So I have friends that are veterans that have served that were in Iraq and Afghanistan, and obviously hearing protection was something that has been a concern for all or many of those veterans. And to know that there's a suppressor like this that is out there on the market now, that even a lot of those veterans that have significant hearing loss because of their time served, this is a great way to combat even worse loss.
Absolutely. The veterans have it worse than a lot of people because they were handed hearing protection that didn't work, that they expected to. There's undergoing lawsuits about that right now. Other large entities or large groups of populations of people, especially in the state of Wyoming. I came from a background of machining and actually being a paramedic for well over a decade. Loud noises are in my history, and I will tell you, I'm right there with a lot of those people, and it's a godsend to be able to go out and enjoy yourself and not have to worry about further damage.
Obviously, again, go to redwhiteandblued.com to find out all the information. You can hit them up if you have questions, if you have caliber that you're not sure is available, they can get you helped out right there. And Toyin, man, I'm glad that we got hooked up and that we're able to chat about this and let people know that hearing is so important and protection is right here in our own backyard, and we appreciate that.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.